I want to shoot that.
Ah, well, okay. Well, as Bodhidharma says, this is the first talk in the series on Buddhist psychology. And I'll just say a few words to introduce the idea of Buddhist psychology anyway. If you go back to the summer, go back to the summer of love, which I do, you know, 1967, and people of my generation, and actually slightly before, and they're either wafting around wearing paisley patterned caftans, beads, bells, really, bells and sandals, and maybe holding incense sticks, or they're sitting, because this is the 60s, they're also maybe sitting quite stiff in suits and possibly holding bowler hats and black umbrellas. That's also part of the audience at this time. And they're listening to Sangharakshita giving a series of 8 talks on this very theme of Buddhist psychology. And it's called Aspects of Buddhist Psychology. And I wasn't there. Slightly before my time. You know, 5 years later, when I first started going along to the centre in Archway, North London, Sangharakshita's recorded lectures were played at every opportunity. You know, you'd go to an evening like this, a Tuesday night type of evening. They might even have been on Tuesday nights, actually. There's something about Tuesday nights. There'd be a meditation, there'd be tea and the biscuits, and there'd be what we called a taped lecture. It literally was a taped lecture. And then a puja afterwards. Sangharakshita's lectures are usually a good hour and a half long, and they're very full and they're very absorbing. So there's loads of material in those lectures, which are still pretty... they still work, basically. And I think these lectures profoundly influenced my early understanding of the ideas of Buddhism, the theory. The practice is something else. But theory is also important because it directs your approach to the practice. In Buddhism, you could say there's 3 phases. There's the theory, there's the practice, and there's the realization that comes out of the practice. There's the idea of the wisdom and the compassion that we're aiming for, we're aiming to tune into, you could say. There's the practice that tunes us into that, and there's the actual wisdom and compassion we end up with at the end of the path. So, with Buddhist psychology, I think the connection is the mind. Buddhism is really engaged with the mind, whatever that is. And there's a whole part of understanding what that word can mean. And it's agenda, that Buddhism's agenda always has to do with cultivation of the mind's innate capacity for wisdom and compassion. That's always the agenda, for awakening wisdom and compassion. That's always the agenda. Contemporary psychology is also about the mind. That's the name. It's about the human psyche. But its agenda is, or has been, more scientific. It attempts to understand the mind. It attempts to understand the mind by looking at it, observing it, experiencing it in all kinds of ways, by analytical learning, the scientific method, through experiment and observation. And it's been very, very successful in our time. It's been a big part of our lives, really. You know, psychological research has produced many useful theoretical models of human development, such as Freud's theories of the unconscious and Jung's five archetypes. And the practical aim is generally to address and solve people's psychological problems. So you can say, I think, that there is a Buddhist psychology, but the purpose is just a bit different. You know, even though our Buddhist practice often does end up helping us with our psychological problems, the overall practical aim is awakening to reality, becoming more real, becoming what we call enlightenment. That's the aim of Buddhism. So this means purifying the mind of unhelpful states, which is a bit similar to psychology in a way. It also does that. But awakening also means purifying the mind of delusions about reality. That's also a big part of our practice. Buddhism has an understanding, an experiential understanding, not just an intellectual, but an experiential understanding, an experiential wisdom, you could say, that relates to the ultimate nature of the mind. That was originally discovered by the Buddha, and that's available to us. It's available to anyone who wants to practice, who wants to put in the, the effort, you could say. Or anyone who's prepared to relax enough to experience it. You know, effort has quite a bit of a different meaning in Buddhism. Anyway, this great realization that the Buddha had is, as many of you know, I'm sure, that of Pratichasamutpada, universal, interconnected conditionality. He saw that all things rise out of conditions. And we can see that a little bit for ourselves. If we just look into our experience right now, if you want, you can, if you just close your eyes a bit and observe closely what's happening in our experience right now. We just notice that our experience is made up of various perceptions. There's these constantly shifting perceptions taking place. Physical sense perceptions and constantly shifting mental perceptions. This is a way of describing what's happening in us all the time. And it's happening now. And to these perceptions that keep coming at us, if you like, or keep arising in us, you could say, we add thoughts and emotions. For example, I'm talking, you're listening. We perceive from what's being said some kind of idea. We don't analyse it. It just happens. It just happens. You know, you're not thinking, I'm perceiving an idea. Something just happens. And that provokes some kind of emotion. You probably don't really notice what it is, but there's some kind of thing going on. And that gets us thinking. And again, we don't really notice that happening, but the thoughts are coming. The thoughts are coming. And we feel a sensation of comfort or discomfort, not necessarily from the words I'm saying, but from some one of these ideas we're having, or just from our chair. Or we hear a sound, we smell an odour, we see something pleasant, or we see something disquieting in some way. And these sensations are constantly provoking feelings, emotions, and getting us thinking. And this has been going on all our lives. You know, once upon a time, each of us popped out into the world, and then it all started. The sensations started. We didn't understand any of it. So it was probably all very intense, and we probably cried. And nowadays we all look very different from what we look like then, and we think we've got it all worked out. That's just how it is. And the Buddha looked into these basic facts about our existence, that our experience is like that. He didn't try and work it all out. He was looking at the overall nature of that reality. That was the way he did come to quite a lot of ways of talking about reality by looking at its nature, trying to understand what its nature was. Not trying to describe it, but trying to comprehend what was really going on. And he saw that it's all conditioned. There is just this open web, you could say, of conditions. It's all the way through. It's like the web of conditions goes all the way through. There's no beginning, there's no end of it. There's no end of the conditions. In a way, it's a simple truth that everything is conditioned. In another way, it's when you look into the implications of conditionality, it's more complex than we can even conceive of. So in a way, it seems a bit simplistic. You say everything depends on conditions. You say, yeah, so what? In another way, you look at the actuality of that and how it really is, and it's too much. The mind can't take it all in. The Buddha himself called it a tatkavacharo, which means beyond the sphere of reason, beyond our ability to comprehend with reason. But whether you look at its simplicity or whether you look at its complexity, either way, it's a very helpful truth. And it's also a very practical truth, because it means we can change ourselves, and we are not fixed. We're something that is completely changeable. It also means we're not someone else's creation. In fact, we are our own creation, and this is really rather an amazing thing to take on board. It's also rather a big thing to realise, because it's got very big implications. It's in a way, it's a big responsibility that we have. We've got this completely open set of potentials, and what are we going to do with that? So the Buddha called all of that, all of this, anatta, or non-self. Atta means a unit or an unchanging core, as though something could be a fixed thing or a unit. And he said there isn't one. I said there isn't an atta. He was radical in his time. He saw this for the first time in his culture. I think we have something a bit similar nowadays with scientific ideas, but he saw it for the first time in his culture at the time that nothing really exists as such. So things obviously exist, but not as themselves, not as what we label things as. The labels come off, as it were. The labels can be changed. The labels come off. Nothing has a true, clear identity, not really. When looked at closely, everything is seen to be made up of parts which themselves, when you observe those closely, are also seen to be made up of parts and so on ad infinitum. If you really look into things, you get into this sort of disappearing web of more and more components, more and more conditions, more and more aspects, and you're kind of saying, well, where is the thing? Where is the thing itself? And it's beyond the sphere of reason, somehow. Eventually. I don't think it is at first. And that's not all, because all these parts, which are not really themselves, but made up of other parts, which are also made up of other parts, all these are mutually and simultaneously influencing one another at the same time. So it's not just that things can be broken up, like taking bits of Lego apart. It's that all the bits are actually having some kind of influence in the world. The parts are alive. It's all alive. It's a living thing. It's a living web, if you like. And it's a bit similar to the concept of ecology. There's a similarity there. You know, we're not just talking about physical things that take up space, but we're also talking about more hidden influences, like biological influences, chemical processes, physical laws like gravity, and influences and potentialities within the minds that perceive all of this within our minds. You know, we also influence all of this, whatever we like. And you get into this thing that there's just nothing but processes going on. And this is where it becomes very, very innocent, incomprehensible in a certain way, in a wonderful way. Again, another analogy is a bit like, similar to the ecology one, it's a bit like trying to predict the weather. When globally there are so many complex conditions of the elements that make up the weather, that even the best computers, fed with enormous amount of global data about what's happening, with the temperature, with the water, you know, with the temperature, etc., they can still only work out a very rough probability of what's likely to happen just in the next few days. It's just too complex, even for the technology that we have. They're pretty good, but they can't really do so very well. So this, I'm trying to get into here the scope of the Buddha's realization of anatta, non-self, which is a bit of an encapsulation of his teaching of praticca samuppada, universal conditionality. So it's looking at this psychologically in terms of our mind, the mind that we have, which also has this nature of this like web-like nature, this amazing connectivity and conditionality. Anatta becomes an extremely helpful teaching. When anatta is translated as non-self, I think it's a bit slightly misleading sort of idea. It's a bit, you kind of think, well, I can't really go there. Non-self, it's sort of, it seems to indicate that we simply don't exist, which is absurd. You know, clearly, obviously we do. But it doesn't take much observation to see that we don't really exist in the ways we tend to assume we exist. And I think this is the real point. The we, or rather the me, is an idea that everyone adds on to their experience. Everyone does that. It's a good idea to do that. We can look and observe that our experience consists of all these multiple perceptions received by the body and the mind, and multiple responses to these perceptions, like we looked at just now. That's what's going on, and we call it me. We call it me. But the me that we refer to is nothing fixed and real. It's a kind of assumption we place at the centre of everything, just for just conventional reasons. We just do it because it works somehow socially, and it fits everything we know in a way. We think in those terms. We think that we will go home after this, for example. We think, that's the way we think, right? We think that we are in a room, right? And we care very much when the me is insulted or ignored or whatever presses your buttons, you know. On the other hand, when the me is given lots of attention, we might like it or we might not find that rather difficult. Or the me is liked or the me is praised. We have all these kind of emotional reactions to that thing, the me, being treated in these ways. All of us do. I do as well. But a practitioner of the Buddha, of the Buddha's teaching, I think should try to take this me less seriously. That's really the point of all this. Because you gradually see more and more that the me is just our idea of me. It's a habit we're in the habit of adding onto our experience, as though it was actually a fixed, solid thing. Whereas, it's just a convenient idea. It doesn't need to be taken so very seriously. Me is a viewpoint we take on life, but it's not one that is ultimately real. The reality is much more like a web or a flow of conditions which are so complex, it's like the weather. So here's an example. Sorry if this feels a bit heady, but here's an example of how this is useful in practice. Sometimes we're, and I think we're all familiar with this, sometimes we're a bit relaxed. Occasionally we have a bit of patience. We don't react with quite so much outrage when someone says something disrespectful. And instead, for a change, we understand that they're speaking out of stress. They're speaking out of ignorance or something like that. They haven't got it. It's not really their fault. They just haven't got it. And we can let it go. So there's an example of us being nice to somebody, say. And when we're patient like that, we're seeing to some extent that the self is not fixed. We might feel the rush, that rush of indignation when someone says something which is slightly inaccurate about us. Or they hear something unfair that's being said about us. You get this indignation. But then there's this reality check. There's a little reality check. And the reality check tells us it's not necessary to react. We know there's no really existing me that is actually being hurt. But it's very interesting to see how pointed some of these comments can feel. You really feel that the me is somehow being, you know, directly manipulated, as though it could be, as it were. It's actually being hurt, even though there's a feeling of pain. There is just the pain. There is just the pain. The pain is bad enough. Okay, the pain is bad enough. I'm not saying the pain is pleasant or anything like that. The pain is bad enough. But at least there isn't a person who is actually damaged. There is just the pain. But there isn't this solid, fixed person who is actually damaged. There is just a moment or a day or an hour or something like that of that pain. And a lot of that pain is quite a conditioned phenomenon. It's something that has come up because we've configured ourselves in a certain way to feel that. So this is the realm of anatta, non-self. In other words, not taking self so very seriously, and not believing in it so much. Yeah, not believing in it, that's maybe a good way to look at it. It's the basic principle of Buddhist psychology, which is our topic. And it's expressed and explored in all kinds of theoretical models and also practical teachings. You know, the practical teaching might have no reference to the theoretical models. And For example, anatta is part of the theoretical basis of meditation. Meditation is about radical transformation, and you just sit down and it happens. You don't need to know the theory, but actually at base of that there's a principle, which is it isn't just out the world out there that can be changed. The one who perceives the world can change, can be changed, can be transformed. We experience this. So in the Metta-bhavana, there might be a view that such and such a person, who isn't here, is not someone we could ever feel anything positive for. That view. Okay, include that person in the Metta-bhavana practice for a week or two, and that fixed, hard attitude begins to melt. It slowly does it, but slowly but surely there's a change. And some of our best friends might begin their relationship with us in the fourth stage of the Metta-bhavana. That's how it can be. But what really changes is not that person who isn't here. It's not that person. It's the meditator that changes. But what is the meditator? Who are we? What are we? Is the psychological question. You know, the psychological model that Buddhism most directly points this, that in Buddhism is mostly pointed out, is the meditation on what's known as the five skandhas. The word skandha means something like a heap or a pile or a lot, I would say. There's this lot over here and there's this lot over here. So everything in our experience is divided into five lots. It's either, our experience is either a physical form, or a feeling, or a volition, a want or a desire, or a perception, or a recognisable perception, that's red, that's green, or a consciousness. So what you do in this practice is to look into your experience and see, oh yeah, there goes consciousness, there goes a form, there goes feeling. And you gradually realise that this solid self you assume is at the heart of things isn't actually there in that way. You stop believing it because, you know, just like you might stop believing in Santa Claus, or you might stop believing that babies come into this world via a stalk, because it's obviously something illusory. It's a story we find useful, but which in the end is something made up. So that's meditation on the five skandhas. And another meditation is the meditation on the six elements. And this we find in the mindfulness teachings. Mindfulness is a Buddhist practice that's been taken up globally by the psychological profession, especially in the field of cognitive behavioural therapy, because its teachings offer a way for people, especially those who become depressed, to train themselves to see things more as they really are. So there's a lot of overlap here with traditional Buddhism. They see that their self is not as fixed and heavy as it can seem, especially when you're depressed. You really take yourself seriously. And they can actually change the way they see the world. We can do that. When this happens to us, we can do that. The mindfulness-based cognitive therapy training doesn't use the six element practice, but there are quite a lot of similarities in the approach. In the six elements meditation, which I think quite a few of you have had some experience of, you experience and observe your body very, very closely. You direct your attention to each of the elements that make it up. You identify the hard edges, the earth element, the kind of connected inner reality of the water element, the liquid that pervades the whole of the body. And then the bodily warmth or its fire. It's fire. You identify the movement and the flow. That's the air. And you identify the feeling of space that's there in the body. And you also identify the awareness that perceives all of this. And that is, oh, none of this would be here if there wasn't awareness of it. You experience all of that directly, indirect experience. And after a while, you start to understand that none of it is owned. None of it is anybody's property. I think we do tend to assume that the body, at least, is somehow mine. There's a sense of ownership. It's not somebody else's. Because that's the way everyone relates to it. That's just the normal way. But look into it. If you look into it, you see that it can't really be like that. It can never really be owned. There's no one who could own it anyway. You start to relate to the real nature of it. There's nothing you see in your direct experience in a convincing way that alters your experience, that there's nothing in the body or the mind that could be owned, that could be any kind of concrete fixed self that could own things at all. So again, this is quite a radical realization. It changes the game quite a lot. So meditations are often aimed in this way at deconstructing, at dismantling the experience of self for a little while, so that we perceive things differently. That's what it's about. More as they actually are. So we relax into something a bit more spacious and a bit more like that web, if you like, of just pure flow. And I think probably all meditations do this to some extent. But another one, I've just got one more thing here. Another one that does it is visualization meditation, which is a more advanced form. Usually this is done by audio members. You might have had some experience of this. And in this kind of practice, the body is imagined as transparent, as it were. There's a kind of transparent, open quality to the body. It's as though it's made of light. And just imagine it's like that in the meditation. And it's radiating flowing light, and it's receiving flowing light from the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, enlightened beings, who are also imagined as empty and transparent, made of light. It's a bit of it's an exercise. And there are also mantras, which are sound symbols, symbolic sounds that are imagined to convey the meaning of the enlightened state. So it's just a kind of play. It's a kind of play, if you like. It's an exercise in light and sound and the meaning of wisdom and compassion. But it also engages our love of beauty. It's a pleasure, basically. A pleasure to do this kind of thing. So our minds can really get absorbed in this kind of exercise of the imagination. And it starts with this kind of deconstruction, looking at the body and looking at our experience in a completely different imagined way. This is really quite interesting. Because when you think about it, we are actually imagining our body all the time. Our experience of our body is largely a kind of imagination. So that kind of practice taps into the imagination that we're using in our experience of our world and our self. And just finally, another deconstruction of the self is to be found in our behaviour and our ethical behaviour. Ethics in Buddhism are based on kindness and truthfulness, basically. It's love and it's truth that changes our mind, you could say, in ethical practice. But actually, to be kind to someone, it usually involves letting go a fixed idea of ourselves. Again, it relates to this idea of the me. The me kind of gets out of the way a little bit in order to be kind. So it involves anatta, it involves non-self. Ethics might not come out of a full awakening to the truth of anatta, but ethics does entail behaving as if one had realised anatta, because one puts aside one's own preferences for the sake of another. One gives to someone who needs something. One listens to something when one might prefer to ignore it. One gives up one's time to help someone, etc., because one feels like being kind in a good way. And these involve behaving selflessly, or relatively selflessly, without attachment to a fixed idea of who I am. I can let that go at times like that. So we behave as if the self was not getting in the way. So I hope I haven't gone on too much. I hope this gives a few helpful examples of some psychological aspects of Buddhist practice. Even though Buddhism isn't the same as psychology, there's a whole lot of overlap, I think. And the insights of both are helpful to each other and have been helpful to each other in our time. And I hope that in what I've said, there's something you can make use of. And I think in particular, this core teaching, that of anatta, will be found useful. So please reflect on what I've said.
Thank you.